This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and what an intersection of history on this day. 1963, marchers gather in Washington to pursue their civil rights and demands for economic justice, while a war in East Asia quietly and secretly loomed. In 2013, the marchers are back. The president is with them this time. He'll speak today at the place where Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of his dream on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But a march toward war in Syria looms in the background 50 years to the day after that march on Washington. We'll discuss all of this on the program today. We'll begin with the developments regarding Syria. The international community is now formally requesting UN authorization for military force in Syria. The UK making the request, drafting a resolution, according to British Prime Minister David Cameron, quote, all necessary measures. That would be an open-ended authorization that would include military force. Four U.S. Navy missile destroyers are in the eastern Mediterranean now, within range of Syria. They are equipped with Tomahawk remote control cruise missiles, widely believed to be the preferred mode of attack. A limited response, according to congressional and White House sources, aimed at preventing more use of chemical weapons, not regime change, although the Obama administration has long said that President Bashar al-Assad has lost any legitimacy as a leader of Syria. Russia is expected to fight the request to use force at the United Nations. Israel is taking defensive action, handing out gas masks to its civilians. Iranian leaders have said that any attack from the West on Syria would result in an Iranian attack on Israel. Let's talk about all this with two people now, both with direct knowledge of how the U.S. makes these difficult decisions to respond militarily. Ambassador Kurt Volker is a former United States permanent representative to NATO. Also with me, Phyllis E. Oakley, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and adjunct lecturer at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Welcome to both of you.
It's nice to be here. Good day to you.
And let's speak with you first. Phyllis Oakley, you were in the State Department when the U.S. made the decision to launch a strike in response to the U.S. embassy bombings in Africa by al-Qaeda. Do you recall the limitations of an offshore airstrike such as the ones being contemplated using cruise missiles that are at least in reports about what there might be as a response to Syria right now?
Yes, I was leading the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department at the time of the bombings of the two embassies in East Africa. And the decisions, of course, were made at the White House, and various people were contributing. The question was not really one of technical ability, of being able to launch missiles or to hit certain targets. It was always a political question. Was this the correct thing to do to achieve U.S. goals?
And is there a temptation to do something just to show that you can respond versus develop a policy that actually will have an impact on the ground?
There certainly is that tendency. And my own view on the two raids, one into Afghanistan and the other into the Sudan, was that there was a very strong feeling in the Clinton administration that we had been hit twice and therefore we had to hit back twice. Now, what if we had just chosen to raid Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden was reported to have been? I think he was there. He escaped any damage. I think the whole world would have been in support of U.S. action after the bombings. So I think the moral of that for me is that you have to be extremely careful in choosing targets.
Phyllis Oakley, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and adjunct lecturer at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Kurt Volker, the limitations of an airstrike in the absence of very specific military goals. Does symbolism get you anywhere here?
I think it gets you a limited distance. There are two reasons that you might consider using force in Syria now. One of them is to deter the future use of chemical weapons, and that's what the administration is focusing on. The other one is to try to have some strategic impact on the course of the war in Syria, and that's where there doesn't seem to be any appetite whatsoever, either in the U.S. or in Europe. In terms of a deterrent, it has to be sufficient enough for both the regime in Syria and then also for potential onlookers who also have access to chemical weapons to feel that it's not worth that usage. So I think a substantial response is called for.
But would NATO then want to have on its record essentially a policy which says, go ahead with your little war there in Syria, just don't use chemical weapons, because that's what the message would be?
Yeah, I would be surprised if this were done as a NATO operation. And I think what you're going to see is a lead-up trying to build both a substantive case based on information that's made public about what the regime in Syria did, as well as a legal case about how this violates international law, use of chemical weapons, international humanitarian law, to say that there is a sufficient basis for a limited response like this.
We're talking with Ambassador Kurt Volker, former United States permanent representative to NATO. So to both of you, Phyllis Oakley and Kurt Volker, back in the old days of responding to the East Africa bombings, the Kosovo operation in the Balkans, the question of U.S. permission or international sanction of an operation like this was a little more straightforward. Now, you know, years later, we have any number of instances of the U.S. acting unilaterally. What is the likelihood that the U.S. would actually seek formal recognition of a response to Syria because of this chemical attack? Phyllis Oakley?
I think it's very clear that the U.S. is not going to act unilaterally. Having lived through some of these legality debates in other circumstances, whether it was Kosovo or going into Iraq, you get into a very, very unclear, murky situation where there are people who can argue it either way. The point is you've got to define what your goals are and your reasons for doing it, gather as much support as you can, and then proceed according to your own decisions. There's never going to be a magic phrase or a magic bullet, if you will, that is going to make this completely legal in the eyes of the world.
Ambassador Volker, there are reports in the New York Times that Kosovo may be some sort of model, an air campaign, an extensive air campaign over Serbia that was authorized only by NATO and not by the international community. Do you think it's a model?
First off, the notion of acting unilaterally and the notion of acting without a UN Security Council resolution are not the same thing. Unilaterally means by yourself. The U.S. acted in many, many instances together with others in carrying out activities. And I think that that's what the administration would try to do with or without a UN Security Council resolution. Then you get to the question of what makes something legal or not legal in international law. And if you go back to the Kosovo time period, there were first efforts by the U.S. and others to seek UN Security Council resolutions, and they were thwarted at the time. And then there was also a very strong doctrine articulated at the time by the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan about humanitarian intervention, which has since progressed, if you will, over time into a discussion about a responsibility to protect in international law if a regime is deliberately killing its own people. Now, that can be pretty open-ended, and there's been a lot of caution about applying that as a general rule. But it just illustrates the point that there's more to consider in international law than simply a UN Security Council resolution. It'll be a complicated argument. It won't be as clean and simple as a UN Security Council resolution might be. But I think that's what you're going to see that would justify a limited response.
Ambassador Kurt Volker, former United States permanent representative to NATO, and Phyllis E. Oakley, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and adjunct lecturer at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're looking back 50 years today since the March on Washington, and we're asking you all this hour, do you think the civil rights movement united or divided Americans of different backgrounds?
My name is Medina Cardona. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. The civil rights movement has united Americans by forcing the issues of race to the forefront, acknowledging the problems, and giving an opportunity for discussion and opportunity for changes, how small they may have been.
This is Carl from Stanford, and civil rights has absolutely united us. We were physically divided and divided by the law. Without the civil rights movement, we would still be living in a backwards country.
I feel it was a driving force for a lot of good things, one of you says in Orange Park, Florida. However, in recent years, the gap in understanding and tolerance has widened rather than closed. From Brooklyn, New York, it seems to have united us for the most part, you say. we have become more tolerant of cultural, ethnic, and just differences in general. More people are willing to stand up and fight for all human rights. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us if you think the civil rights movement has divided or united Americans of different backgrounds. And we put this question to Americans in a new Takeaway YouGov poll. 58% of folks ages 55 and older said that the civil rights movement divided Americans of different backgrounds, while 30% of people 18 to 34 believed it united diverse Americans. More generally, what do Americans think about the achievements and remaining mission of the civil rights movement? 65% of those surveyed between the ages of 18 to 34 cited LGBT individuals as the group that does not enjoy full civil rights today. 45% of folks under the age of 40 think illegal immigrants should benefit from full civil rights. The full results from the Takeaway YouGov poll will be available on our website later today at thetakeaway.org. And 50 years after the March on Washington, as America contemplates the path to a better future, we remember Dr. King's dream and how it became the footsteps of 250,000 people dedicated to change.
The fact that this was a march for jobs and freedom is still a critical issue. The wealth gap between blacks and whites in America doubled during the Great Recession that we just had recently. And so when I look at the narrative of race, what I'm looking at is also economics, jobs, and the ability for this country to really provide an American dream for all. And I think we have a lot of work there.
That's Farai Chidea, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Journalism Institute. Peter Blair Henry is dean of New York University's Stern School of Business. He says the gulf between rich and poor that has grown in 50 years makes it difficult for us all to march together.
One of the real challenges we face is this rising wealth gap, because the median white family, household of three, has roughly 20 times as much wealth as the median black family. It means lack of access to education, college, which is, of course, the key driver in your ability to access technology and use technology in a way to empower real fundamental change.
And a thought from New Yorker staff writer George Packer, whose book The Unwinding sketches a chilling picture of America's diminished capacity to move forward beyond the poetry of Dr. King 50 years ago.
There is a sort of rigging of the game against people who don't have access, who don't have the right connections, and who don't know how to play the system. It may be comforting to think that merit is rewarded and that it's all a matter of where the chips fall, but how can it be that so many people who used to be gainfully employed no longer are? People who used to be able to support their families no longer can? Is that really because of some failure of their own? I think those questions, those moral questions, are front and center in our politics today in a way that they were not 10 or 20 years ago. And in a way, those questions are the questions that I think a new March on Washington would ask.
More thoughts from George Packer, Peter Henry, and Farai Chidea on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington after a break. As the president speaks today to America, to the ages, and to a much smaller crowd of marchers than heard Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years ago today, what should be his message, and who needs to hear it? The times were troubled in 1963, and yet the mission may have seemed clearer. Fair labor standards, decent housing, desegregated schools, a higher minimum wage, job opportunities. The government responded in 1963, first with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and then the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But who holds the power that needs to be shared, and who can move the levers of change in America today? Are we stymied somehow as we look ahead to the next 50 years? Listen now to Farai Chidea, distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Journalism Institute, Peter Blair Henry, the dean of the New York University's Stern School of Business, and George Packer, staff writer at The New Yorker. Farai Chidea says America's paralyzed institutions have produced a national crisis of confidence.
Today, people view the government as broken, and therefore the government doesn't really have that power that it did before. Black people could not get justice in states in the 1950s, so they went to the federal government. Today, state-by-state strategies may actually work better politically.
John, to me, one statistic really kind of captures this in my mind, because Americans, I think, are big believers in equal access to opportunity. and letting outcomes fall where they may if there's a level playing field. And right now there isn't a level playing field. And I think the statistic that captures it best is the fact that if you're born in the United States in the top 25% of the income distribution, you have an 85% chance of going to college. If you're born in the bottom 25% of the income distribution, you have an 8% chance of going to college. That is not equal access to opportunity. And in the private sector, if we want to be a country that continues to grow, then we've got to take joint responsibility in the private sector out to say, well, gee, we've got a role in actually making education, higher education, more accessible to the masses in order to level the playing field. Because again, the key equalizer is education. That's what transforms people's lives.
Although those are seeds that would be planted this week and may bear fruit in 50 years or a generation, it seems to me what was going on 50 years ago is a sense of retro income redistribution to force givebacks of some of the gains of the last 20, 25 years and to confront the government in a way that we really haven't seen in 50 years. I don't see Americans doing that. They aren't going to demand retro sort of compensation for people who have gotten so rich in the last 20 years. And they're certainly not going to demand equality tomorrow in access to education. We can barely afford the education today. George?
And I think you're right, unfortunately. In that 63 march, they were marching for jobs and freedom. And jobs came first in that slogan. And the unions had a great deal to do with the success of the march because they were the main organizing muscle in getting people to Washington. They paid for the sound system on the stage. And among the many demands that the people at that march ratified after the speeches were over was a $2 minimum wage, which today would be a $13 minimum wage. The actual federal minimum wage is $7.25. So we're not even close to what they were asking for in Washington in 63. They were also asking for full employment. And A. Philip Randolph, the godfather of the march, said, what is the use of a Fair Employment Act if automation is destroying jobs in this profit-making system? I mean, it was close to socialist talk. And the next year, Lyndon Johnson established a commission on the effects of automation on jobs. And who was on that commission? Businessmen, labor leaders, civil rights activists, religious leaders. In other words, elites who represented institutions that could come together across lines of interest and come up with solutions that suited the national interest. We don't have that anymore. Can you imagine business leaders sitting down with labor leaders to come up with some solution to the problem of the unemployment that continues to persist after the Great Recession? It just doesn't happen any longer, and I think it's because both the elites and the institutions they lead no longer have that larger vision that they had back in 1963.
All right, then to all three of you. Are we past a point of no return in some sense in America in 2013, or are we still on some sort of course that's maybe harder to see than what Martin Luther King saw when he looked out from those steps 50 years ago? Peter?
I think that, you know, George made a good point. We've lowered our expectations in this country. And when I was on your show some months ago, John, I talked about the tiny island of Barbados. And there's a turnaround story in Barbados. I think that's a great example of how you can actually come together to have a bigger vision for a country. And without going into the details, the private sector, labor unions, and the government in Barbados got together in 1992 to avoid devaluing the currency because they all said we need to save the country. And we need the same sense of urgency in this country around addressing in a fundamental way income inequality. I think that we in this country need to be humble and look to some examples of countries like Barbados that have executed on these kinds of turnarounds.
Look outside ourselves.
Exactly.
You know, we are on the brink of demographic inevitability, that this country will become a majority, quote, minority population country. And what I think is happening right now is the death throes of privilege as we know it. And what's happening is that that privilege is being reshuffled. And one of the things you see is a deep anger among some people who had privilege and lost it. And that is why we are so, I think, enervated right now as a country. We are seeing some very ugly stuff. But in the end, it will all unfold. And I believe that we will come together out of necessity, not necessarily out of love, but out of necessity and fix some of these problems.
So the anxiety of transition is what we are feeling now. It's not past the point of no return, as Farai tries to pull me back from the ledge a little bit. All right, let's end on that demographic point. And George, Peter, and Farai, I think we all agree there is this demographic inevitability. When we get there in 35 years or 50 years, when it isn't really about white and black in the way that it has been in America for so long, is this new society going to be able to handle this stuff when the whites finally say, okay, it's up to you guys, we're out of this, we're a minority? What's your sense of hope about them, George?
I don't have the same faith in demographic inevitability. I mean, there will be these numbers, but will they bring changes in politics and changes in sort of the moral vision of the country? And I'm not certain that's going to happen. I mean, we've been living in a period of greater and greater inclusiveness and social equality, and at the same time, greater and greater economic inequality. And I don't see anything that's going to keep both of those trends from continuing unless there's a change in our politics. And that's up to individuals and it's up to leaders. And that's why 1963 and that day in Washington is a great inspiration, because it showed that the power of language and of vision can move people to change their country.
Final thoughts, Peter Blair Henry?
I'm optimistic. I'm in the business of education because education is about transforming people's lives. And we've got to pull people into the leadership class from the bottom of income distribution. That's the key to the future.
Peter Blair Henry is Dean of New York University's Stern School of Business. Farai Chidea is a distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Journalism Institute. And George Packer is staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the book The Unwinding. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now to the wildfires in Northern California. The blaze around Yosemite National Park is 2 weeks old. It covers 280 square miles, larger than the city of Chicago. Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency in the area all the way west to San Francisco, where residents fear that the Rim Fire could take out their water and power supply. The governor said with the help of the federal government, he's confident they can get the fire under control.
The president called me just yesterday. He expressed his support. Whatever we need, he'll provide. So between the state and the federal government and local officials, we'll get it done.
Christina Wilkinson lives just 3 miles from the fire in Groveland, California. She manages a Facebook page to get emergency information out to local residents. She joins us from her home for more. Welcome, Christina.
Yes, glad to be joining you.
And what's the top of the agenda on your Facebook page as far as the requests for information are concerned?
Oh, well, we just got one about 2 minutes ago. I was just answering, and somebody basically wants to know what's the safest way to get to the Yosemite Valley floor from where they're at.
And, you know, the residents where you are taking steps to evacuate potentially, yes?
We did last week. We had a lot of people evacuate last week, and people have trickled back, and we only have one area that I'm aware of that might still be evacuated, but it backs up right towards a brush area back by the airport and stables.
How much of this is, you know, a cliffhanger in the sense that you're aware of dry weather, you're aware that there's a lot of fuel on the ground that could fuel a fire like this? When a week ago this was like 6% contained, how fearful were you?
Oh, wow. You know, it was pretty frightening, seeing the big plumes of smoke coming out from behind our town and knowing how close it really was, not realizing how close it really was. I think that was the hardest part, was not knowing. Yeah, it everybody going out there to see what's going on and then going towards it more so and then saying, wow, that's right in my backyard.
Is this your first big fire with a robust Wi-Fi capability to exchange and share information?
Absolutely. First time.
Does it help, or does it just keep you at your home maybe longer than you should be?
A little bit of both, actually. We came within a mile and a half of the fire with our home, where my husband and I update the Facebook page for Groveland. And basically, it's kind of kept our minds off of the fire itself while exchanging information that's accurate about the fire. So we kind of felt the need to stay put to help locals out, because they're looking at us for information, for accurate and correct information at that.
Sounds like we need a webcam on your house, Christina Wilkinson. Tell me about what would have been expected in terms of the tourist business this time of year.
Well, this time of year, we would have been able to go downtown to Groveland and do our regular weekday shopping so we could avoid the weekend, because that's when all the tourists come up. This weekend specifically, because Labor Day weekend, it's packed. You can't go to the lake, can't go to the marina, you can't go. A lot of places you can't really go, or you shouldn't really go as a local, because it's just, we live here year-round and can enjoy it year-round, so you kind of make time to do things around the tourists.
So the fire and the tourists together there in Groveland, California. Stay safe, Christina.
Thank you.
Christina Wilkinson managing that Facebook page there in Groveland, California, in the middle of the fire zone around Yosemite National Park.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Wildfires in Northern California, but it's trying to ignite something that burned out some time ago that is the focus in Southern California. Hollywood might be best described today as the home of award shows, not the preeminent maker of award-winning films or any other kind these days. And in a bid to woo big production companies back to the Los Angeles area, newly elected Mayor Eric Garcetti promised to hire a film czar to make the case for broadening film industry tax credits at the state level. Sharon Waxman, founder and CEO of TheWrap.com, joins us once again to talk about the economic crater in Tinseltown. Sharon, first of all, what do you make of this film czar idea, and how far behind the curve is Los Angeles in getting a film production business back?
Los Angeles is very far behind the curve on this problem, and Eric Garcetti declaring a state of emergency yesterday and giving me an interview when he was sworn into office, saying that this is a big focus of his mayorship, is an important moment. But the truth is, the situation has been dire for at least 3 years. So Los Angeles, which used to be the center of production for film and television, has been rapidly losing that status to cities like London, New York, New Orleans, Vancouver, for many years already, and in a really serious way for at least 3 or 4 years.
You know, I'm surprised, and here's Eric Garcetti talking about these tax credits. I was surprised that L.A. didn't have this program in place. We take it for granted here in New York, where we're constantly driving around film trucks because there's shoots all over town. Here's the mayor of Los Angeles in his inaugural speech at the end of June.
Meaningful tax credits for our entertainment industry isn't some showbiz boondoggle. It means more jobs for the middle class, more tax revenue. It's our neighbors, it's our florists, it's our bakers, it's the people in our neighborhoods that other cities and states are tripping over themselves to get.
I mean, why hasn't this been the case all along in California?
Well, here's the thing. You're absolutely right about that. But at the same time, the mayor of Los Angeles has precious little power to do anything about production flight. That's the reality. So what Eric Garcetti is doing is using his office as a bully pulpit to talk about the issue. And his decision to appoint a film czar is more about creating a stir and a conversation around the problem. But he actually doesn't have very much power to affect it. He does not have a budget to give tax credits, which is the core of what would lure production back to California. That's in Sacramento.
So describe the chain of events that's really made this flight happen in Southern California. You know, I remember the studios, and of course there's huge post-production houses, industrial light and magic, the special effects shops. All those businesses have really been affected by this?
Yeah, you're touching on a particularly sensitive point. Post-production, which is a huge part of the budgets of these big movies, special effects, things like that, that has just gone all over the globe. And it's had a devastating impact on these companies. ILM is one of the few left standing, actually. But a really important sort of signpost of how things have changed is that the new Star Wars is having its effects done in London. London. So what's happening with the effects houses is they are having to chase tax incentives all over the globe. They move. The tax incentives, the countries and the cities compete with one another, sort of kind of a race to the bottom to see how much money they can give back to the producers of the movie. And the studios then make their decisions entirely based on that. So you may move a production from one part of Canada to another. And then those companies have to move their facilities from one to another, and they end up, we've had lots of bankruptcies in that part of the industry as a result of that.
And technology probably enabling being able to set up anywhere as well. But the London thing doesn't bother me so much because, as we all know, Sharon Waxman, space aliens do have a British accent. Sharon Waxman, founder and CEO of the Wrapped.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
By now, most Americans are aware that their faces are being watched by the growing number of surveillance cameras on the streets of America. The nation watched as the Boston bombing suspect was identified using surveillance video. But quietly this year, facial recognition technology that allows investigators to search for matching faces in a growing database of images has been rolling out. Very quietly, it turns out, in the state of Ohio, where a Cincinnati Inquirer newspaper investigation revealed that Ohio's Bureau of Criminal Investigation has been using facial recognition technology extensively without telling the public. We'll ask Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, who also wasn't told about the program before it was launched, for a reaction in a moment. But first, Chrissy Thompson, state capitol reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, who discovered the program in a public records request. Hundreds of emails that show who was left out of the loop and how the program arrives in a real gray area in state law.
We had been hearing about facial recognition systems throughout the country and did a little bit of looking, and there's really nothing in Ohio law that addresses it. And there was only really one request from the Attorney General's office for approval for a contract to develop something like this. But I did not know that the program had launched. So to find out that the program had launched in June without notifying the public was a real surprise to me. And also the emails talked quite a bit about launching the program without notifying the Attorney General. He was aware the program was under development, but he hadn't been notified before it was launched. And then once they told him, about 2 weeks after they launched it, the emails revealed that there was quite a bit of hand-wringing over what should we do at this point. And they did decide to keep the program live, but only at that point did they start discussing, are the security protocols that we have for who is allowed to access this, how secure is it, that sort of thing. Only then were those things discussed.
So it's, let's get the technology first and work out the rules later?
That's right.
How outraged have people in Ohio been over this? And is there any evidence that an arrest has come from anything to do with this program, this facial recognition technology?
Well, the reaction has been really interesting. A lot of people have been saying, well, we know that there are cameras everywhere. I don't mind if they're watching me because I'm not doing anything wrong. A lot of the frustration and outrage has been about having the program launch without anyone knowing about it. This program allows the officers to match photos of suspects or from security cameras with the driver's license records. So a photo of a suspect could be scanning through all of the Ohio driver's license records and matching up to 12 people that look like this photo. So far, the system has been used about 2,700 times. They have made some identity fraud matches. And there was also a case where an abandoned baby carriage had some bloody baby wipes in it. And there was also a family photo in the carriage, and police officers were able to match that photo with the driver's license record and come up with the identity of that person. And the baby was okay, but they did come upon a domestic dispute.
So you're on camera there in Ohio. Very interesting. Chrissy Thompson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chrissy Thompson is a state capitol reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer who helped to break this story. We wanted to give a chance to Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine to respond to that report and just to the whole idea of facial recognition technology there in Ohio. Attorney General Mike DeWine, welcome back to the program.
Oh, good to be back. Thank you very much.
So is this a public service from the Cincinnati Inquirer to disclose this program, or do you have a little egg on your face because of this idea that you were out of the loop here?
Well, we're not out of the loop. That's what's kind of funny about this thing. You know, as your listeners across the country listen to this, the odds are their state does exactly what we are doing. And there's no new cameras. There's no new pictures. This is these are really the essential facts. 28 states do this. What we are doing is creating no new database. We are simply using the database from our BMV, which is our Bureau of Motor Vehicles, our driver's license. You go in and get your driver's license taken. In virtually every state, law enforcement has for decades had access to the BMV records. Law enforcement can pull those down. And that's exactly what we are doing. The only difference is we're now using facial recognition technology to do it more efficiently and do it quicker. A guy walks into a bank or walks into a convenience store. He is caught on a security camera, which is not run by the state. It's security cameras of that local place. And, you know, before we had this system, what would happen is you would show it, it would be shown on TV, and everyone would say, who is this individual? Who is this individual? And you try to identify that person. Now what we can do is take it a step further, and we can take that photo and electronically match it with BMV photos of millions of people in the state of Ohio who have a driver's license. So no new technology, it's new technology, but no new database.
But isn't this capability pretty significant? I mean, you could at a Cleveland Browns game or a Bengals game take a picture of somebody as they enter a stadium, get a driver's license picture of them and an ID in a matter of seconds, and then go to their seat and tell them that they have some back taxes they need to send to the Ohio Attorney General.
If that would be done, that person who did it would be under Ohio law guilty of a fifth-degree felony. We would put them in prison, and we have done that in Ohio. We have numerous cases. I shouldn't say numerous. We have a significant number of cases over the years where people have abused what's called OLEG, which is the gateway where people, law enforcement, it's only accessible by law enforcement, where they can go up and get data. We added to OLEG this facial recognition ability. And so in the past, we've had police officers who've gone into the BMV records or gone into criminal records for their own purposes. They're curious, or they got a girlfriend they want to have checked out or something. Well, that's a felony in Ohio. And so when the reporter from the Inquirer stated there was no safeguards, and we only started talking about safeguards after the fact, after we put it up, that's simply not true.
All right, well, so there are laws against doing that, but now it is public. And Mike DeWine, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Mike DeWine is the Attorney General of Ohio, reacting to a report that Ohio has a facial recognition program that law enforcement uses, a program that wasn't disclosed to the public until the Cincinnati Inquirer did it. We've already spoken of the difficulties facing America in extending the dream of Martin Luther King Jr. and so many of the activists who made history 50 years ago today and believed in a changed future back then. We'll leave you today with two people who we believe directly inherit the spirit of activism from those days. See if you don't agree. Rashad Robinson is the executive director of Color of Change, and Majora Carter is the founder of the nonprofit Sustainable Bronx. Their spirit may be the same as those marchers 50 years ago, but Majora says it's the tactics that have changed with the times.
Whether it was 50 years ago or now, the bottom line is there are so many opportunities for us to advance the work that was started 50 years ago. I'm really interested in how do we continue the quest toward economic diversity, economic equality, environmental equality, and really bringing those to the table in support of people of all colors, and in particular, the poorest among us who have consistently been left behind.
You know, I think the assumption was 50 years ago that the civil rights movement set in motion a kind of inexorable logic that would include everyone. And so we would proceed from African Americans, to gays, to people with disabilities, to other communities. Even at the time, 50 years ago, there was resistance to including the anti-war message in the civil rights message, to including the economic message in the civil rights message. And subsequently, there has been resistance in terms of including other groups, gays and lesbians, transgender, people with disabilities. What is the reason for that debate, for that resistance, for the slowing down of that inexorable logic? And how are those debates being resolved in your view, Rashad?
I think the debates are being resolved by the culture we live in. But if you look at this past election and the election before presidential, and you saw this rising American electorate of young people, people of color, women, gays and lesbians coming together and electing and reelecting this president, and doing it not just out of their particular silos, but using technology and communicating across communities. At Color of Change, we believe that when oppressed people win, everyone wins, right? The efforts for immigrant rights or gay and lesbian rights or rights for black folks, which is the community we serve, are not just victories for those communities leading the efforts, but for all of us. And we have to really work to empower the folks who are most oppressed, who are facing the most challenges.
What do you make of the notion of silos? And is it more difficult today to craft a universal message of human rights in the United States?
One of the saddest things that I've noticed about folks that are striving for any kind of right that they want to fight for is that I think we tend to get very involved in thinking about, you know, we're fighting for crumbs, as opposed to recognizing that, you know what, we can actually go out and buy the ingredients to bake a whole new pie. And that's where I think we kind of miss the boat in terms of understanding that we don't have to continually silo ourselves. Like, I do believe that every great movement that we've had a struggle for some kind of equality has always benefited everyone from an economic standpoint to a societal standpoint to a psychological one. You know, when the early settlers wanted, you know, rights to become their own country. And then later on, of course, you know, blacks that were enslaved were like, hey, there's other, we'd like our freedom too. And women were just like, we'd like that as well. And so I think it's really interesting that instead of recognizing that we are all in this together and that there's, you know, great support in supporting each other, that we will continue to fight amongst ourselves.
Citizens United basically opens the floodgate for money in politics. Corporations are people, according to Supreme Court decisions. The private sector is the engine of our growth and jobs and prosperity. We can't get government involved in that. That's sort of the Tea Party argument, the argument that changed Congress in 2012. How is 250,000 people on the Washington Mall today going to fight against that set of resources that the private sector has in its disposal?
Well, in some regards, I actually have something in common with the Tea Party. I think that there should be a smaller government in some regards, especially when we think about, or when I think about, the fact that the most effective and cost-effective form of social service is a job. So with that regard, it's really important that those who are striving toward social human rights and really thinking about how can we take this really bizarre place that we're in right now where corporations are people too, and how do we insert ourselves into pulling what's good about that and taking it in support of our communities. That's why when I think about where Dr. King was at the end of his days, like looking at the poor people's movement and recognizing that it was way broader than just rights for black folks. And it was, there was definitely the class thing going on there and the anti-war thing as well. And then it was really clear it was about the destruction of communities. And how do we rebuild them and, in particular, create more opportunities for economic diversity in them so that it's not just poor people, but there are people who are moving up and out of poverty as a result of very deliberate decisions around economic development, land use, housing, and really building the kind of communities where people can grow and prosper.
So are you talking about a march on not Washington this time, 50 years later and 50 years in the future, but a continual march on shareholders' meetings, opening corporate democracy, modifying corporate governance, opening the economy?
Absolutely. You know, the March on Washington 50 years ago was a smart strategic tool to advance a certain set of legislation that people felt like in the fierce urgency of now, and A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and the other organizers felt like they needed this strategy at that moment. 50 years later, we have to have new strategies. We live in a very different world. We live in a world where we don't have to march on Washington to reach our representatives. And we have a tremendous amount of tools at our disposal, both from a technological perspective, but we also live in a news cycle that's incredibly quick, where putting all the resources behind future marches over and over again may not have the same type of return on our investment. And so for us at Color of Change, when we think about what's happening in the world every single day and we try to transfer those moments into movements using digital technology, we need to, you know, celebrate and remember things like the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, while at the same time thinking really big and aspirational about how do we use technology, how do we use storytellers, like the stories of the Dreamers or the Marriage Equality Movement or the Dream Defenders who are occupying the Tallahassee State House. All of these things have to be part of our toolbox if we're going to, you know, have the same type of successes that they had 50 years ago.
I get it that both of you have kind of had it a little bit with symbols, as emotionally involved as you are with this 50th anniversary.
Yeah, I'm a little too old and a little too jaded to focus too much on symbols itself. What I am is incredibly hopeful about what the future holds in terms of seeing, you know, we had this incredible group of people 50 years ago who laid a foundation for what we can do. And I'm just really grateful that I, among many, many others, are working to create the kind of future that is going to make life better for folks.
Majora Rajad, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Majora Carter is the founder of the nonprofit Sustainable Bronx, and Rashad Robinson is the executive director of Color of Change. So talking about that foundation 50 years ago, are we more or less divided today?
Hi, this is Tim, and I'm calling from Mineola, New York. I see mixed-race couples all the time. It seems much more accepted than in my youth. My wife is Asian, and I'm Caucasian, and even my redneck family in West Virginia loves and accepts her. Would take her side in any dispute.
One of you in St. George, Utah says, I believe the civil rights movement continues to divide the nation. We'd love your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.